Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Sex Trade Ordeal. Listen to the inspirational life story of a former prostitute who quit her job, became a Catholic, and set up a shelter to help other sex workers leave the trade and start a new life. Unwanted daughters. We find out how millions of baby girls are going missing in India due to the growing practice of aborting female fetuses because of the strong traditional preference for a boy. But first we begin with a report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday General Audience.
Thousands of pilgrims gathered in Paul VI Hall on Wednesday for Pope Benedict XVI's weekly General Audience, during which the Holy Father continued his catechesis on Christian prayer with a reflection on the prayer of Jesus at the Last Supper, when our Lord instituted the Eucharist, the sacrament of his body and blood. Jesus' gift of himself anticipates his sacrifice on the cross and his glorious resurrection, said Pope Benedict.
The Eucharist is the supreme prayer of Jesus and of his Church. At the Last Supper, with his overturn of the Passover and the commemoration of Israel's liberation, Jesus' prayer echoes the Hebrew Beraka, which includes both thanksgiving and the gift of a blessing. His act of breaking the bread and offering the cup on the night before he died becomes a sign of his redemptive self-oblation, in obedience to the Father's will. He thus appears as a true Paschal Lamb who brings the ancient worship to fulfillment.
The Holy Father noted that Jesus' prayer also invokes strength for his disciples, especially Peter.
May our celebration of the Eucharist, in obedience to Christ's command, unite us more deeply to his prayer at the Last Supper and enable us in union with him to offer our lives even more fully in sacrifice to the Father.
After the main catechesis, the Holy Father had greetings for pilgrims in many languages, including English. Among the Holy Father's special guests at Wednesday's audience were representatives from the Zoological Garden of the City of Rome, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary. With the zoo representatives was an exemplar of an extremely rare and critically endangered species of Cuban crocodile, which survives only in a tiny portion of protected wetland on the island. The animal had been in the care of experts at the Roman Biopark and, having returned to robust health, will return to his native country in a singular coincidence, as a press release from the Biopark and the press office of the Holy See calls it, when the Holy Father travels to Cuba later this year. I'm Chris Altieri.
For an inspirational story that sprang from a somewhat unlikely beginning. Prostitution is often described as the oldest profession in the world, and it's arguably one of the most despised. But sex for money exists no matter where one goes in the world, and statistics show that in many countries, business is booming. In the UK, for instance, the number of men who frequent sex workers has nearly doubled in a decade. We hear nowadays how a growing number of those working as prostitutes are the victims of people traffickers who have forced them to become sex slaves. But what about those who have chosen this profession? What are their feelings about their job? And what is the Church's response to prostitution? Well, I've been finding out more.
It was an abusive life. It was a soul-destroying life. You hate your clients. I hated doing what I did.
Linda Watson is a former prostitute turned campaigner who worked in the sex trade in Western Australia for 20 years, initially as a prostitute and then as a brothel manager or madame. After quitting her job at the brothel, she set up Linda's House of Hope, a shelter that helps other girls to leave the sex trade and start a new life. In 2003, she was named Australia's most inspirational woman by the magazine Women's Weekly for her work on behalf of others. Linda first got lured into the sex trade by the promise of high earnings when she was an impoverished single mother, struggling to support three children. She told me more about her first impressions.
My first client, I guess we always go back to the first client, was a high-profile media executive. I was quite amazed that somebody so powerful, so rich, and in such a high position. And I thought, oh, I had from the butcher to the baker, right to these high-profile people. But I guess you soon learn that most of them lack integrity. 99% of them are married. And you think, wow, hey, what's marriage? There is no trust. Why would you want to get married if your man's going to go to a brothel, huh?
And what were your feelings about them? I mean, did you sometimes feel sorry for them? Did you despise them? Did you fear them?
I guess you switch on and off. I think you learn very quickly that you to survive, you're going to think, I'm just doing this for the money. You know, you could be reading the paper almost. It's just such a cold transaction. So you're not really trying to focus on the person that you're with. You're focusing right at the beginning. We're going back to my beginning thinking, this will make money. I'll do this for a couple of months and I'll get out. And there lies a real danger too, where you just totally switch off.
So you never came across anybody who treated you with even a slight degree of respect?
There's a lot of people who were very, very nice. Also, I learned that they were very insecure and, you know, I'm not a man hater. They also hated themselves for having to pay for it. I guess underneath, they had a problem. There were nice men who would talk to you. There were men who would cry because their wife didn't understand them. And so you think, oh, poor person. But really, the underlying thing is the fact that it was deceitful and they lacked integrity. That I learned very quickly, and I got very disillusioned. The reality is nothing like the Pretty Woman movie.
Linda says the sense of shame was so strong that she tried to conceal what she was doing from those around her.
I mean, I concealed it from nearly everybody that I could think of. I quickly got a nanny in. The money was rolling in. I mean, I was supposed to earn $2,000 a week. I earned $5,000 in my first week. You're certainly not going to tell your kids. But then you sort of think, right, I feel so dirty. And I remember coming home showering, had so many showers because I felt so dirty. And I certainly lost that part of even being a mother because I even when I went to cuddle my kids, I felt so guilty. So I really did shelter them until they were old enough for me to tell them because I was really concerned that there would be somebody that would tell them.
Linda originally only intended to work as a prostitute for 2 months. But as she explains, once you get sucked into the sex trade, it's very difficult to escape.
It was very difficult to get out because the money entrapped me, the lifestyle entrapped me, and I guess I lost who I was. I lost my will, you know, my self-worth. I mean, I knew it wasn't right when I went into it. I went into a whole different sort of a world.
Drug use and prostitution each tend to fuel the other. And Linda says a very high percentage of sex workers become addicted to drugs.
98% of the girls that are working are on drugs. If they come in clean, they're certainly not going to stay clean for very long.
Why is this such a problem?
Because it's an emotional job. It's also the fact that these girls are doing 8 to 15 men a day, and some are doing 20 clients in one shift. So they are needing something to fuel their bodies so that they can continue to do the job. That actually gets them to stay in the sex industry.
But although the vast majority of prostitutes do find it very difficult to leave the sex trade, Linda was able to buck that trend. She told me how one day she decided she'd had enough and wanted to start a new life.
There was a lot of aspects for me leaving the industry. My mother's prayers, for start, she prayed for me for 20 years. She never stopped praying for me to get out of the industry. And I had so many bad experiences. And when Princess Diana died, I guess that was a pivotal moment that I thought, all the money that you can make isn't going to make you rich. I guess there was a whole pile of issues of seeing all the pain and hurt in people's eyes over 20 years and my own pain. I asked for God to help me and his guidance that night, I think August the 31st, 1997. I just said, God, if you're really there, reveal yourself to me. And I couldn't put it more clearer that I cried out for God to help, and he did.
But what was so unusual about Linda was that once she left the sex trade, she didn't forget those she'd left behind. Instead, she decided to go back and rescue others from the sex industry.
I had a passion on my heart, and I guess the other side of it as well is 20 years, who was going to employ me? I was 42 years of age, and I wasn't ready to lie down and not do anything. But I guess the defining moment was that what can I do with my life and what purpose can this serve? And I guess the biggest thing for me was that the government was about to legalise prostitution in Western Australia. And that was the pivotal moment that I sort of said, right, this isn't going to happen. And from there, I had a burning passion to save others and to warn others not to do that. Don't go down that path.
But as she told me, trying to find support and backing for her idea of opening a shelter to house former prostitutes proved incredibly difficult.
Difficult was an understatement. I had banged on doors for 2 years, and I got to the stage where I sort of went to every possible places that I could think of that I could go, and every door was closing. You know, people were starting to even laugh at the fact that I was still continuing my search for this dream or vision. And I said, I have this passion and vision that I can provide a home, I can do something for people, but everybody's shutting the doors in my face.
But one day, a door was not banged shut in her face, and Linda was given that vital helping hand.
I could not believe how he welcomed me with open arms, and he believed in me, and he believed in my vision, plus fighting against legalisation. He was an answer to my prayers.
The answer to Linda's prayers came in the person of the Catholic Archbishop of Perth, Barry Hickey. It was he who helped her to set up a shelter for former sex workers. Here's his side of the story.
Linda rang me, almost in desperation, saying, I was a madam and I've pulled out of the industry and I want to rescue girls. Can you help me? I immediately said, I don't know how to help you, but I will help you.
Was it an easy thing to do? Were other people trying to dissuade you from it? I mean, how did you go about it?
Well, I waited for 2 weeks and said I'd call you back, and I did. And by then I'd resolved that if she needed accommodation, I would provide at least one house, and we've been able to do that. And now she has a second house, which is the house where the prostitutes mainly stay. But there was some surprise, a lot of surprise. Some people shook their heads and said, what's he getting into? But generally, the support has been great.
Archbishop Hickey remains actively involved in Linda's project and says through his association, his eyes have been opened to how much the sex trade exploits these women.
I visit the place every couple of months and I meet the girls that are there at any particular time. There are lots of success stories, girls being very grateful that they had a chance to escape that prison of prostitution and have a chance to do some studies, to get some skills and to get other jobs.
And what have you learned on a personal level from your involvement in this project and from your talks with these people who are trying to escape from the world of prostitution? I mean, has it sort of broken down, should we say, some stereotypes that many of us may harbour about these women?
One of the things Linda has always said is that there is no glamour in prostitution. And I've found that out too. The lives of these girls are anything but glamorous. I've discovered that most of them have entered prostitution against their will. They themselves have been abused in many cases and have very low self-esteem. I've also found out that my opinion of men generally is not that good. They exploit these girls to cross every section of society. Most of them are unfaithful to their wives. It is not a good scene. There is a lot of exploitation also by the people who control the prostitutes. So I see it as a grimy trade, and I'm glad Linda's there rescuing these girls.
In Britain, Dr. Elaine Storkey is a well-known Christian author and sociologist who is president of the Christian development charity Tear Fund. She has done several studies on prostitution and has been involved in faith-based projects to try to rescue sex workers from the trade. Elaine believes the Christian churches often have a tendency to be too judgmental when it comes to the issue of prostitution. Instead, she says, what is required is a sense of compassion.
why is it that they're trapped into this lifestyle? Why is it that they have so little respect for their own bodies that they're willing to use them in this kind of way? And I think just talking to women and trying to give them more self-respect and more body sense that's positive rather than negative is also what we can do. I think where we failed a lot is just simply seeing prostitutes as immoral people whom we need to legislate against and hound out of our patch. They're real human beings with great needs and often very bad backgrounds, and we need all the compassion we have to actually work with them.
Elaine told me how even a single kind gesture can succeed in reaching out to what many perceive as hardened sex workers.
There was one project in the UK in an area of London well known for prostitution, where a bunch of churches decided to get together and on Christmas Eve go around all the known prostitutes in the area with a rose, a single red rose, and not with a tract and not with a complaint or anything, just with a rose to say, this is Christ's birthday, we want to share something of what we feel about Jesus Christ and with you, and then leave the rose with them and wish them a happy Christmas and go away. And one of the women who had received a rose spoke to me, and she said it broke her heart. She had no idea that the God that the church believed in was a God who actually loved her. And she had that rose, and she said when it died, when it finally died, she just wept and wept and wept because somehow something of herself had gone into that rose. So I think a lot of women are feeling very negative about themselves in the job. A lot of them are struggling to get out. A lot are very, very defensive because they feel they're being judged by others. And then a few do feel that this is a perfectly okay lifestyle and they're going to stay with it. It's very mixed.
Returning to the situation in Australia, how does Archbishop Hickey evaluate the Catholic Church's response to prostitution? And how much help does it provide to those trying to get out of the business?
I would say that only on an individual level is much else being done. Occasionally a prostitute will approach a priest or a convent for help, but that is rare. I think Linda's project in this part of the world is the main contribution that the Church is making by supporting her.
So, in your view, a lot more could and should be done?
Yes, I think government and the community generally should support efforts to rescue these girls. The scene here is very different from trafficking that goes on in third world countries or from third world countries to Europe. We have some trafficking here, but not much. Most of the prostitution is by local girls in local brothels controlled by local people.
And when it comes to the men that use prostitutes, is the church speaking out enough against the fact that they should not be doing this, that they are exploiting this women?
I do use opportunities that come my way in the media to say those things. But generally, prostitution is glamorized. The image of a prostitute is one who is wealthy, who is having fun, and who wants to be where she is. It's a completely wrong picture. We're doing something, but we're not getting enough publicity because I don't think people believe us.
When you say you don't think people believe us, what do you mean by that?
I mean that they think that if the church speaks out, it's just speaking out about outdated moral code. But when people get close to prostitutes, they see that their lives are very sad indeed. We have very little legislation, so prostitution is on the rise, but we want better legislation to control it, but not to license it.
Why is prostitution on the rise, in your opinion?
I think it's the general culture of the country, where personal freedom is emphasised to such an extent that prostitution is seen to be a man's right, and it's mainly men who look for girls. It's just part of the general culture that people can do what they like and nobody should put up any moral barriers. Also, it is not generally understood that the girls are harmed by prostitution and exploited. And that's the message we want to put out there to men.
Perhaps not surprisingly, Linda's courageous decision to help rescue girls from the sex trade has earned her many enemies among her former associates in the business. She told me how on numerous occasions she has risked death because of her stand.
When I first left the industry, I spoke to a madam and she threatened me and asked me to leave town and this wasn't going to happen and she wasn't going to stand for it. And then I got shot at. I've been shot at, firebombed, threats, nearly kidnapped, people nearly through my roof. Can't count the death threats. It's been horrendous.
But you're carrying on.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have my dignity back and I have something worthwhile fighting for and I believe in what I do.
But regaining her dignity and self-respect is just one of the rewards Linda has found in her new life. A Catholic convert, Linda says her greatest moment came when she met the late Pope John Paul during a visit to Italy in 2004.
Well, I met the Pope. Wow, that was just the best reward that I ever had. I just felt like, oh my God, I'm standing here right in front of the Pope and here I am. It was just like redemption for me. I just felt like Mary Magdalene standing there in front of the Pope. That was my greatest overwhelming, and of course I'd won the most inspirational woman of Australia, and that didn't mean as much as meeting the Pope.
That was the voice of Linda Watson, a former sex worker turned campaigner, and you also heard the voices of Archbishop Barry Hickey of Perth and Elaine Storkey, an expert on prostitution. In India, becoming pregnant with a baby girl can have fatal consequences. Such is the traditional preference for a boy that millions of female fetuses are being aborted, and the number is rising each year. Some commentators have called it a silent but massive suppression of human life on a scale that is almost akin to genocide. Girls in India are often viewed as a burden, not least because tradition demands that a girl's family provide a dowry for their daughter's marriage, even though the practice is illegal. Sex determination scans for pregnant women are also illegal, but the law is widely flouted. Often when the parents discover through the scan that their unborn child is a girl rather than the longed-for boy, the decision is taken to abort the fetus. The Catholic Church in India has spoken out strongly against the practice of female feticide and has earmarked the 8th of September as Girl Child Day to help persuade parents of the equal worth and dignity of both boys and girls. Cardinal Oswald Gracius is the Archbishop of Bombay. He calls the selective abortion of baby girls in the womb a diabolical practice.
I think because of the whole idea that the girl is a second-class citizen, we are trying to fight against that forcefully. You see, traditionally, a girl in many places was considered a burden, partly sociologically because economically she had later on take dowry, etc. Therefore, families did not consider it a blessing when a daughter was born, but it was a blessing when a son was born. Now, with the possibility of determining the sex of the fetus, people have got into the idea of female feticide. And this, as you can see, is diabolical because it's not only taking life, but also taking life selectively of women.
But how many baby girls are being aborted each year in India? And where is the practice most common? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Sister Lily Francis, who heads the Catholic Bishops' Commission for Women and Children.
Around 500,000 female fetuses are aborted every year.
And where is the practice most prevalent?
It is practiced in Punjab. For every 1,000 boy children, they have only 300 girl children in some part of Punjab. But even Delhi, it is affected. Delhi ratio, as per the census, 808 girls for 1,000 boys. Also, we see the third child in the family, usually the ratio goes much, much low. 312 girls for 1,000 boys.
So in many areas of India, there's now a very distorted ratio and a glut of boys in a way.
Maria George Loy is a Catholic sociology student in New Delhi who has done research into the practice of female feticide. She spoke to me about the widespread bias and discrimination against females in Indian society that help explain this growing trend to abort baby girls.
I think the reason why it is increasing is that women are constantly being considered as a liability in India, because of factors such as dowry. And women are considered as a liability because of the dowry amount that has to be paid when they get married. And because they are getting married to a family that is outside, the woman does not prove as an asset to her own family in which she was born.
Experts say that although Indians know that female feticide is being widely practiced, thanks to the growing availability of sex selection scans, people don't like talking about it openly. And in many of these cases, the pregnant woman is being forced against her will to abort her unborn baby girl because of pressure from her husband and his family. There are some cases where the pregnant woman will rebel against this pressure to abort her baby girl. But as Loy explains, when women do this, they run a serious risk of being badly beaten by either her husband or his family.
Women, when they rebel, they are battered, they are pushed and they are kicked so that the child somehow is aborted.
So you're saying that if the woman does not agree, violence is likely to be used against her?
Yeah, if she opposes that, yes, I will have my child against the wishes of the family, she is battered. Many succumb to the pressure, and even if the child is allowed to live, she is not looked after properly by the in-laws, or the woman is not encouraged enough to educate the child, or she's not given the means to educate the child or to look after her properly.
Despite the worrying statistics, Cardinal Gracious says he hopes the trend towards aborting more and more female fetuses will diminish eventually, as people come to realise the implications of this practice.
I think that as people get more educated, as people get more enlightened, as people the world is becoming more and more a little village, people see the role of women in society, I am hopeful that this trend will gradually begin to diminish, and I hope it will die out completely.
There's a saying in Indian society that raising a girl is like watering a plant in your neighbour's garden. With attitudes like this, there's little wonder that so many females in India are being denied the right to be born. But, as Loy reminds us, it's difficult to change deeply rooted attitudes and traditions in a hurry. Happily, as Loy herself made clear, she does not share the bias against female children felt by so many of her compatriots. Let's end with her views.
This attitude does prevail, and I think it has nothing to do with education as such. It is a mindset that has been inculcated in the people, something which is widely said around, that the girl child is a liability to the family.
Are you married?
No, I'm not married.
But when you say were to get married, I assume that you would be fighting very strongly for the right for any girl child that you were carrying to be allowed the right to be born.
Yes, definitely. I would love to have a lot of girl children, and I will definitely fight for her rights.
I was speaking there to Maria Loy from Delhi, and you earlier heard the voices of Cardinal Gracious, Archbishop of Bombay, and Sister Lily Francis. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.